Okay, great. All right. Well, welcome, everybody. Welcome to our October call. I particularly want to welcome those of you who are new to Citizens Climate Lobby. And in particular, I want to welcome the chapters that either started or restarted since last month's call. That includes Beaumont, Texas, Tri-Valley, California, Michigan, the University of Michigan, Oshkosh, Wisconsin, St. Andrews, Delaware, Chesterton, Maryland, Florence, Alabama, and of course, Lahore, Pakistan. So if you're on from Pakistan, thank you for being up this time of day and for being on the call, and it's great to have a chapter there. What's going to be happening in just a moment, I'm going to be introducing our guest. We couldn't be more delighted than to have David Jolly, former Republican congressman from Florida. Mr. Jolly was one of the original members of the Climate Solutions Caucus, and he was also one of the first people to sign on to what we now call the Republican Resolution. At the time that it was first introduced, we called it the Gibson Resolution. And Mr. Jolly is pretty familiar with the organization. He's spoken at our conferences, but there's just one thing I want you to know about the people you're talking to today. I don't think you'll ever talk to anybody who will be actually in action making more things happen than the people you're talking to today. So I just want to give you a few stats of the things they've just done so far in the first three quarters of this year. So far, just in the first three quarters of this year, they have met 852 times with members of Congress. They've had 27 editorial board meetings. They've published 2,349 letters to the editor and 341 op-eds. And then they're also willing to jump in when something needs to happen elsewhere. So we work primarily on a federal basis, but Washington State has a carbon tax in play. A lot of organizations are asking their membership to help. 20% of all of the phone calls that have happened in Washington State have been done by the people that are on this call. And a lot of those are people who aren't even in Washington State. They're just jumping in there trying to make something happen. So what will happen is we'll unmute Mr. Jolly's line in just a moment. We changed the format this month. Usually we ask our speaker to make a 10 or 12 minute opening statement and then take questions, but we wanted to get to as many questions as possible given the breadth of Mr. Jolly's experience. I heard some of you, as we were welcoming everybody, say that you've seen David on TV quite a few times. And if you notice, if you ever see him on the talk shows or the political talk shows, he's always the most thoughtful person in the room. He's always the person who's looking from the broadest point of view, and that's why we wanted to get as much Q&A as possible. Now, in your case, David, if you decide to filibuster on one particular answer, if you want to take 10 or 15 minutes, that's completely fine.
No,
we'll be cool with that. Okay, but first of all, you're calling in from Florida, right?
I am. But here's my only filibuster. Here's my pitch, because I knew who I was meeting with. I apologize for being underdressed, but I'm going to try to show you the T-shirt I'm wearing because it's perfect for CCL. Let's see if we can do it.
Nice. Okay.
When
okay,
I left,
we love
I
it.
Office, my wife and I had a maid, and I don't think we realized what the last couple of years were going to mean and how important the message is. So thank you for having me with you today. Look forward to it.
Yeah, great. And so is your part of the state okay? Were you affected at all by Hurricane Michael?
You know, some parts, particularly the St. Pete chapter, some of the low-lying areas that are susceptible to flooding, had some flooding. We had some, you know, some high water, but all in all, it passed us by. The panhandle is devastated. The imagery you see is real. For those who don't know Florida well, it's one of the less populated parts of the state, which from a national perspective, I suppose is good, but if you are in the eye of that storm, those words bring little comfort. There is a lot of recovery. And still, you know, lives hang in the balance right now. And so we've got a lot of work to do down here.
Yep. Okay. Thank you. So a lot of questions came in. And one of the things that's been asked by a lot of people is your view on what's going to happen with the midterms in the House and the Senate. So if you could tell us how you think that will go and obviously we're all guessing, right? But what do you think is in play in determining how you think things will go?
So look, if you were to take a snapshot today, and this changes almost by the day, the most likely scenario is the House flips. The House could flip, you know, we could see 40 seats change, and it's a margin at 23 necessary to flip. And then you look at the Senate, and the Senate likely stays Republican. That's a snapshot of the numbers today. Two caveats to that. The first is, our polling truly has not caught up with the emergence of social media. And what I mean by that is, if you look back at 16, we know that polling misses social media intensity. We don't have perfect ways to measure that. And so polling is imperfect right now. The other thing we don't know is, how long does the Kavanaugh bump really help Republicans? Is it a permanent help to Republicans? We know it's energized both sides, but it did close the enthusiasm gap some. At this point, I would say, if you're looking at trying to take the House, I'd much rather be on the Democratic side than the Republican side. The odds favor Democrats to take the House. If you're looking at the Senate, you'd much rather be on the Republican side simply because the math is incredibly tricky for Democrats to take the Senate. For Democrats to take the Senate, watch Arizona, Nevada, Indiana, Florida. If we end up in a really blue wave and those states go, that means the Democrats likely take the Senate as well.
Wow. Okay. And speaking of Florida, obviously our organization is really, really interested in Mr. Curbelo's race.
Sure.
And so initially the Cook Report had that as toss-up. And then when Mr. Curbelo introduced his carbon tax bill, it went to lean to R, it's back to toss-up. How can you give us any insight about how you think that might go?
So look, Carlos is one of those members who does his very best to represent his district first and his party second. And you're seeing that on leading on climate issues. We need Carlos, Carlos' voice, at least within the Republican Party. Whether or not, you know, people on this call think he should continue in Congress or be replaced by a Democrat, that's everybody's own opinion. Carlos has been a leader on climate issues. He's worked very closely with CCL. He is in a position as a Republican to win a Democrat-leaning district by the numbers because of that type of leadership on behalf of his district. His is one, though, that if he loses, it really is because of a blue wave and nothing that he could have done to stop it. He is one of those few Republicans that is almost perfectly positioned for his district. But if there is a macro environment where Democrats just really sweep on November 6th, it could be enough to take Carlos out. At this point, though, again, all you can do is take a snapshot today. A snapshot today would suggest that Carlos pulls it out by a couple points.
Wow. Yeah, I think that the vast majority of this people on this call are pulling really hard for Mr. Curbelo. And I certainly have a lot of NGOs who are wringing their hands saying, you know, they're not thinking of it as a blue wave, but what if somebody who has a carbon pricing bill and a Republican and loses, and then everybody wants to throw in the Bob Inglis story? You know, I always find it curious about what happened in 2009. So Bob Inglis introduces the Raise Wages, Lower Carbon Act, right? But Jeff Flake was on that bill too. And right. Almost nobody points to the fact that Jeff got elevated to the Senate. He didn't get hurt by that.
Sure.
So I think that we've oversimplified that story.
So what happened, and you're exactly right. Listen, there was a point at which this entire concept, you could have said originated from this kind of free market conservative side of the aisle, and it could have been a standard Republican orthodoxy. And be what it may, the emergence of the Tea Party in 2010 and the climate change denier caucus, if you will, that really overtook the Republican Party in 2010 has given us a generation now, a new generation of Republican political leaders that are resistant to conversations about climate science, and many of them actually deny it. And so that wave within the Republican Party forever transformed where the party is, and it's why you see today Jeff Flake on his way out. It's why you see Carlos in the minority. I do think a question would be, and in some ways, you know, I'll be honest, I made a statement a year ago and I've stuck with it. Personally, my opinion, only my opinion, I think we would be better with divided government. So I have said that it is my preference that Democrats take the House in November. I would love to see what a leader like Carlos Curbelo on the Republican side is able to do with a Democratic majority. Because what I mean by that is now you would give breathing room for the Republicans who are currently acknowledging climate science, who are on the resolution that CCL has continued to push, to be able to truly work with a majority that will advance that. Right? The challenge for Carlos and the caucus right now is Republican leadership won't move legislation that understands and acknowledges and responds to climate science. Democrats, if they control the floor, will move that legislation, and it will bring to the forefront leaders like Carlos Curbelo and his Republican peers who are trying to talk about this issue and address it.
Okay, so I want to come back to the science issue in a little bit, but I want to just ride on something there. So you have Carlos and two other Republicans who introduced a carbon tax this year. So I know he prefers to call it an infrastructure bill, but it's funded by a carbon tax, right? And you have six Republicans for the first time ever who voted against the Scalise resolution, and other people who voted present or didn't show up to vote. And we heard a lot of grumbling on the Hill about how strong-armed a lot of people felt about that vote from leadership. So what do you see is happening there? I mean, we were encouraged by both those events. I mean, a Republican in 2018 says, I can introduce a carbon tax, and people vote against Scalise. What do you see is happening there?
So, look, this is an area where, and one of the things I've always respected and admire about CCL is the willingness to engage in outreach, work with Republican legislators, understand kind of where they may be coming from the right side of the ideological spectrum. But we also have to have an honest conversation that there are more legislators willing to approach climate solutions on the Democratic side than the Republican side. And we are always going to come up against this. And on the Republican side, what we come up against are members, in the case of Mr. Scalise, who happens to be in leadership with great influence, but a Republican-controlled Energy and Commerce Committee that is frankly adherent to a lot of deep corporate donors and ideological donors that will forever obstruct climate solutions. We're not going to change that until we change the legislators. And that doesn't mean it has to be a switch over to the Democratic Party. It may mean that we eventually in the long game have somebody like Carlos get to a seat at the leadership table where he can begin to influence leadership decisions. But look, if you take Scalise, I mean, it's straight out of a movie, right? You've got a guy from Louisiana who is going to be a pro-oil, pro-energy guy. He is supported financially by that industry. He is never going to really want to find a solution on climate because it's simply not going to fit the orthodoxy with which he's emerged into leadership. That is where it is fair to make assessments about our individual legislators and whether we believe that they deserve to continue to serve in that role.
Okay. Well, so there's a lot of big news from our perspective this week. You had the Nobel Prize awarded to Mr. Nordhaus, Mr. Romer, Mr. Nordhaus being the first economist I was ever aware of writing about this from an economic perspective. And then you had the IPCC report come out. So we have generally found it counterproductive to talk about science or organizations like the IPCC with Republican members of Congress. Given the urgency of that IPCC report, do you recommend we still stay away from that in Republican offices? Because it's a tricky balance. You know, you have something that's extremely urgent, but the social science says lighting your hire on fire and running around is counterproductive.
So, look, I think you can't ignore it because you would be ignoring your own convictions. I mean, I always say the three rules of approaching a legislator, keep it personal, keep it professional, keep it parochial. And what I mean by that is, look, it's deeply personal to people that this report came out suggesting almost a doomsday scenario within the next generation. That's a personal issue. And we should expect that our legislators, regardless of party, understand it's personal to us. And we are asking for their assistance. Keep it professional means understanding the limits of their reach, if you will, right? Carlos Curbelo is a perfect example to understand there's only so much he can do within the Congress, and so we're going to keep supporting him as he does that, but we can't beat him over the head because he hasn't, become the next majority leader and is able to move climate legislation. Keep it parochial is the accountability piece. Listen, this is your member of Congress. You're allowed to say, I expect you to vote this way, and my decision whether to support you may or may not be influenced by that. The one piece substantively that I would add to what you've said, and this was the case I tried to make, Carlos tried to say, we're going to take a climate bill, make it an infrastructure bill. I took a little different approach that I think also resonated with many people on my side of the aisle, which was the ability, if we invest in climate solutions, to dramatically transform industries and to dramatically relay savings to families and households. And what I mean by that, solar is a perfect example of a renewable energy with a very small footprint that if you talk to businesses, the reason they decided to finally start adopting it was the return on investment now was within a window that made sense to them. It became profitable to them. And if you are able to translate those savings also to customers and to households, you know, when we had the stimulus bill under Barack Obama, I wasn't particularly supportive of the economic theory of stimulus, but the case I made is if we're going to spend $1 trillion, what if we spend it on one thing, a Manhattan Project on energy that reduced our household energy bills by 80% and transformed us into a more clean energy environment? If we can show Republicans that you may not want to say, I'm going to embrace this UN report and I'm going to decide all of a sudden to abandon everything the Tea Party's told me about climate and I'm now going to become a true believer. But if you say, look, we expect our legislators to address what is legitimate climate science. And in doing so, Republicans, perhaps you can also create an opportunity for industry to emerge more profitable, to transform industry, and ultimately to translate cost savings down to every single one of your constituents. Leave in the pure economics of it outside of the free market theory, but actually the profit-driven agenda that you often see from kind of the Chamber of Commerce caucus on the Republican side, I do think there's a window there to soften the approach, if you will, of approaching a Republican with a UN report.
Okay, great. Ricky, I'm going to ask you to monitor the questions in the chat. We'll just start with one of ones there already. There was a question about asking you to comment on the Exxon donating $1 million towards the Climate Leadership Council proposal. Now, their proposal is quite different from ours. Ours starts at $15 a ton and ramps up faster. We get to $100 a ton a lot faster than they do. But they do start at a higher price of $40 a ton, and then they have a specific regulatory rollback of the Clean Power Plan, and then there's also some tort reform where you couldn't sue oil companies for what happened in the past. So there's a big difference between what we're proposing and what they're proposing. But nevertheless, Exxon committing $1 million to something related to climate, I think has to get a lot of people's attention.
It does. Listen, I'd say beware of intentions, beware of motives. We know that the trade-off is something that we have to examine. It is very different, say, than Florida Power and Light in South Florida deciding that they wanted to be an industry leader, and it made sense economically for them to move to within compliance of the Clean Power Plan. So they, you know, we now have a large utility company in Florida and the Southeast that they're fine with the Clean Power Plan because they've already moved in that direction. You know, Exxon is suggesting that part of their solution would be a rollback of the Clean Power Plan. Look, at the end of the day, it's important they're engaged in the conversation. I hate to be a cynic, I'm always suspicious kind of tobacco companies contributing to anti-tobacco campaigns. At times you have to be suspicious, are they checking a box? But look, having them at the table is better than not having them at the table, and I think we certainly owe them due credit for that.
Okay, good. Okay, the next question I see here is a carbon tax bill in early 2019. What are the chances and how do you see that unfolding? And I mean, obviously that depends on the makeup of the House also, right?
Yeah, it really does depend on the makeup of the House. I gave the scenario, if Democrats take the House, I truly am excited to see what could happen to say the Curbelo bill or even just a resolution of some sort, because you would have a voting block that would move it through the House. I would expect we would see a climate science bill, whether or not it's carbon tax. I mean, what will happen if Democrats take over is there will be a reorganization of the Energy and Commerce Committee, Ways and Means, and all the other committees. The chairs will have their own priorities, their own ideas. And the reality is on both sides of the aisle, you know, people who serve as chairman or chairwoman, they think it's their committee, their ideas. Sometimes they're the only person with the solution. And so we are going to have to do some convincing of the chairperson that the Curbelo approach is, or the CCL approach is the right approach. I would be very optimistic if Democrats take over. We will see climate science legislation move, and carbon tax very possibly could be a part of that. My concern if Republicans retain the House is this. The one scenario we're pretty certain of, I can't see any other scenario but this, is the Republican conference in the House, whether they take the majority or end up in the minority, is going to be more hardline, more Trump-like, not less. If you look at who we're losing you know, we're losing the moderates, we're losing Frelinghuysen, we're losing Ross Layton, and all of those purple districts, those are the ones that are going to get swept out first if the member hasn't already decided to retire, which many of them have. Who we will see left as a percentage of the caucus, it will be a much more Trump-like Republican caucus in the House, which would suggest that Carlos or whoever is leading the charge on the Republican side of the aisle when it comes to climate solutions might have a harder uphill battle in the next Congress.
Some of our membership worries that if the Democrats take the House, they're going to see if they can run cap and trade up the flagpole again, which we are not big fans of. We think it's overly complicated, overly bureaucratic, and generally just not a good idea. Do you have any thoughts on that?
This will come down to who ends up in leadership positions on the committees. There are numerous examples of this. What has happened to Congress in the past, two decades really, is it has gone from what we all remember in textbooks and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, where a bill starts at the committee level and goes up. Both sides of the aisle now, it is top down. And part of that is because Congress has just become non-functional in many of the standard operating ways we used to see it function. But it also is a tip of the hat to high dollar money. And what I mean by that is Paul Ryan and McCarthy and Scalise sit with committee chairs and decide what they want the Republican agenda to look like. And that is in part based on ideology, but largely based on who is providing the financial support for that party's agenda. And so that agenda is driven top down from leadership down to the committees. Democrats will have the same exact dynamic should they take over. And so whether it is a pure carbon tax, whether it is cap and trade, whatever that looks like, the chief influencer is going to be leadership as opposed to rank and file. But that does not mean rank and file will be totally silenced. And frankly, if a committee leader prefers the CCL solution, you're sitting perfectly situated, and that's exactly what you want. If not, we've got to lean on members to lean on their committee chair to say, hey, let's look at the CCL provisions and let's see how we incorporate that into a climate solution bill.
Okay, good. Next question that came in the chat is about state initiatives. What's most prominent right now is what's happening in Washington State. They have a ballot initiative that will be voted on November 6th. Right now, the polling says 50% in favor, 36% against, 14% undecided. We know that on ballot initiatives, they tend to get less popular the closer they get to the election, so it's going to be important that those 14% of undecided are affected. But the question is more, if there are multiple states that start to enact carbon pricing mechanisms, does that exert additional pressure on Congress to say, this is going to drive business crazy at some point if they have to comply with 10 sets of rules when we could have one?
Sure. And I think you would see some Republican attorney generals or attorneys general in states too to stop. You may see arguments of preemption, have the federal government say we can't have under the Commerce Clause, 50 different sets of rules. But I say that only kind of to answer the questions of caution. I personally would be very encouraging about state ballot initiatives. Every state is different on how you get ballot access. A lot of states are fairly rigged. Florida is one where it has to go through a commission that is largely controlled by the governor and the legislature. And so it is rigged kind of for the ideological leanings of the majority in Tallahassee. However, we can do it by signature. And so we have a couple ballot initiatives this year that have been put on the ballot simply by signature. It is a long effort. It can be a multi-year effort and unfortunately requires significant financial support. So I'm encouraged we are seeing voter-driven ballot amendments on a lot of issues, from primaries to gerrymandering to climate, whatever it might be. I think that's a very good thing, and I think we should keep the energy behind that as much as we can, understanding the challenges that if it is truly going to be voter-driven and in some states overtake the will of the majority in the state capitol, it will take several years and it will also take a fair amount of money.
Okay. There's a question on the Senate side. If Democrats do take the House, or even if they don't, if we're able to get something through the House, You know, who are our best targets in the Senate to, particularly on the Republican side of the aisle, to reach out for leadership on this issue?
I will let you know when I find one. And look, you know, the Senate, I wouldn't expect much out of a Republican Senate, I guess is the final thing I would leave what on that topic. But for where I do think there are opportunities, let's say you had a comprehensive climate solutions bill come out of a Democratic controlled House, it likely would not even have a hearing in the Senate, but which is fine. Look, this is progress, right? And it allows us to keep the spotlight on and understand where the Senate math is very bad for Democrats this year. It gets much better for Democrats in 2020. And honestly, again, it's just snapshot and projecting any polling is tough. But the areas where Republican support is softening are actually those very areas that put Trump over the top. I mean, Democrats could be looking at a very favorable 2020 environment. Here's something, though, to look at that could be done between a Democratic House and a Republican Senate. And it comes down to the annual budget process. You know, some of the investments we make in energy accounts through the annual appropriations process, some of the investments that we make in EPA, where Republicans have continued to starve some of these accounts, now there has to be a compromise or you'll have a government shutdown. And so you'll see a Democratic House begin to shift priorities away from, you know, perhaps defense, although I wouldn't anticipate defense being much even under a Democratic majority, but you will see a reprioritization of better investment in environmental and clean energy accounts, and then they will push that over the Senate, and there will have to be a compromise or the government would shut down. I think that is an area where CCL should pay attention to for opportunities for real progress should the House switch.
Okay. Two more questions then. One is, I like this question that came in the chat also is, you know, should we encourage more members of Congress to actually move their family to DC so they're spending more time with each other in the district rather than going home every weekend?
This is a national conversation and should be. Sam Gibbons, who represented the Tampa area in the 1980s, 90s, he was there for about three decades. He said bipartisanship ended with the invention of the jet airplane, meaning members of Congress now fly into town for 3 days. What was not even anticipated then was as fundraising took over the political culture and as partisanship really became more entrenched, now you fly to town for 72 hours, you only see the people on your side of the aisle and you only see the people who are handing you checks. You are rarely working with members on the other side of the aisle. So, you know, there's other questions. Should there be a housing allowance for members of Congress? Should we increase staff size? The reality is many of you have met with members of Congress and their staff. We have a lot of people working very hard, but we don't have climate subject matter experts in every congressional office. That's a function of budgets. But who's going to lead and say, I think we need to triple the budget of Congress and we need to give them a housing allowance. And we need everybody to move to Washington, because you could flip it completely on its head and say they already get paid too much, they already spend too much money, and they should be home in the districts. I'm not the person to solve that debate. It is an important one that I think the conversation should continue nationally, because we are not getting the best we can get out of Congress. I often say we have a part-time Congress in a full-time world, and we see the results of that.
Okay, the last question, this came in from a lot of people, which is there anything you can tell us about what's next for you?
You should invite my wife on this call. look, I don't know. You know, I've worked with the Hill in Congress for 20 years, a little bit more. I had virtually every position. I tried to leave three times. It kind of drew me back in. At the same time, though, I didn't run for office to keep running for office. And so I really don't know. I anticipate I'll be on the ballot again. I just don't know when or what office that might be for. When the good Lord and my good wife tell me, I'll know. I recently did leave the Republican Party. I've now registered as a no party affiliate, an independent. It was the right decision at the right time for my wife and I. We're expecting our first child. And I say, very importantly, I mean this, I want our daughter to know for 3 years we fought for what we believed in. At the party I belonged to, I believed we could answer to better angels. I want her to know we stayed and we fought. But I also want her to know that at times there are fights that wiser men and women walk away from. And so for now, I'm a political independent. In most states, including Florida, you don't really have ballot access as an independent. A donor base is very tricky as an independent. So I don't know what the future holds for me politically. I expect to be very involved in the 2020 presidential race. I know that, but beyond that, we'll see. We'll see.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. This has been fantastic. There are additional questions that came in the chat that we'll get to you in case you want to address them.
But
I think, yeah, this definitely exceeded our expectations. We're so grateful. And if you want to stay on for the next 10 or 12 minutes, you're welcome to. But I know it's a Saturday. And as Ricky says, we shouldn't have these calls on college football days. His team's playing right now.
Last thing I would say is, one, thank you for what you're doing. There really are not the subject matter experts we need on the Hill. You provide that. Don't stop, because you provide the expertise, you provide the advocacy, but ultimately the accountability. And so thank you for what you're doing. Thank you for the invitation today.
Great. Thank you, David.
You got it.
Great to have you. Okay, so I want to go over a few things that have happened so far this year, some of which we'll be repeating from the start of the call, but all of you as an organization have added 19,125 new members this year. As I said earlier, 852 meetings with members of Congress, 27 editorial board meetings, 2,349 letters to the editor, 341 op-eds, the first carbon fee and dividend municipal resolution in St. Petersburg, Florida. Again, congratulations for everybody on that. 2,335 outreach events, 37,482 personal letters to members of Congress. The Los Angeles Times editorial page talked about carbon pricing and how much they preferred our proposal over the Climate Leadership Council this week. The editorial that came out of North Carolina mentioned not only Citizens Climate Lobby, but Don Adu, our staffer down there, and the Climate Solutions Caucus. So that was really, really nice to see also. So I'm just coming back from the regional conferences. And we finished our fall round of regional conferences. Then we'll have Congressional Education Day coming up in a month, and then we'll have another round happening in the spring. I just want to mention one really interesting thing in two particular cases being out at the regional conferences. Agriculture always comes up in the part of the world I was, because I was in the Midwest for two regional conferences. And there were two ranchers that really shared remarkable stories. The first was a bison rancher, and our organizer had the key luck fortune to go with him when he was rotating the bison. So both of the people I'm going to mention are growing, in his case, bison, and the second one, cattle, in the kind of sustainable way we all hope will happen. So the bison graze in a particular area, they get moved, they restore the land by what they leave behind, and then they move on to another area. Well, our organizer was lucky enough when they moved the bison and they went to open a gate, and the person who was with him said, "Do not get out of the ATV." And imagine this, the guy opens the gate and 1,000 cattle went running by. I mean, excuse me, 1,000 bison. I mean, that just sounded way too cool. And then the second was also in South Dakota. Sorry, everybody. I'm going to turn this phone off. Hold on. Nine, four, seven, three, four. Sorry about that, everybody. Exactly what you plan to plan for and then don't. So the second one was a cattle rancher, and he wasn't like the person driving up in his old VW bus. This was the standard cowboy hat, tall, big pickup truck, also grazing his cattle with sustainable practices. Here's what I thought was so dramatic about what he said. 2 years ago, his energy costs for moving hay in and manure out of his ranch were $12,000 a year. Last year, it was $700. And he said the other farmers, I mean, ranchers around him are noticing what's happening. So it's just really interesting to watch and see how the agricultural panels are evolving in the regional conferences, because there's always a really big part of what happens with our Midwest regional conferences. Okay, I want to talk about Congressional Education Day that's coming up in a month for just a moment.
So first of all, there's already 173 appointments scheduled. So there's already 173 appointments that we'll be having, will be the first people on the Hill after the midterm election. Danny Richter has finished reviewing all the meeting notes, and on November 1st, we'll be showing you some of the results of that. And some of it's really, really interesting. So for instance, of the meetings we had in June, 23% of those meetings were face-to-face in the Senate. 23% of Senate meetings were face-to-face. If you take our committees of jurisdiction in both the House and the Senate, so for instance, Ways and Means in the House, Senate Finance in the Senate, 21% of committees of jurisdiction were face-to-face with members of the House or Senate. So that was also really important. One of the things that's become obvious in the analysis this year is which issues are not just important to Congress, but which are predominantly Republican and which are predominantly Democratic issues. So that'll be an important part of our briefing. And then one of the things that Danny does, I know this is a little bit tricky and subjective, but he attempts every year to measure the tone of the meetings. So just in Republican offices, are they engaged? Are they asking interesting questions? Are they any way and dismiss it? When we started doing this analysis, it was a 3-to-1 ratio of three, what we call good meetings to bad. The next year it went 6-to-1. The following year it went 10-to-1. Last year it went 20-to-1, and Danny figured that that was the plateau. 20-to-1 ratio probably wasn't going to jump up from there. But this year again, it went 28-to-1. So there's something that you're doing in developing your relationship with members of the House and Senate where they're more engaged as we go along rather than less engaged or not interested. 28-to-1 is a really, really good number. Okay, I want to mention also that what's happening in Washington State. So in addition to many of you making calls for support, Bill Gates lended his name as an endorsement this week, which I'm hoping has an effect. Again, the polling says 50% for, 36% against, 14%. If you look at your action sheet, you'll see that there's a bonus action. And the bonus action is you could actually call in to make some of the phone calls for or set up a calling party for Washington State. And in the chat should be a link of how you want to do that, if you want to do that, how you would go about doing it. Okay, so what are we doing this month? In Canada, we've got our conference and our lobby day in Parliament Hill, so everything's really focused around having a successful event with Congress in, with Parliament on Parliament Hill. In the U.S., a lot of you just called in regarding the IPCC report, and the number of calls was fantastic. We had 45% more calls for the IPCC report than we did for the Scalise resolution, so thank you for everybody who called already. But we are going to have another call-in day in support of Congressional Education Day. So we'll be asking you to call the Friday before. If you don't call on that specific day, please make sure you call in some other time. But we also want to, for the district staff, thank them. So, you know, you might thank them by giving them cookies or flowers, or you might have a picture of all of you. You know, one of the most rememberable moments for me on the Hill was in former Senator McCain's office. I'm talking to the receptionist, waiting for the meeting to start. I asked how it's going. She said, "I'm not completely cynical yet. I've only been here for a year." So I paused for a second and I said, "Really?" And she said, "I wish every American had to answer our phones for just 1 hour." You know, I just think we can do better than that. And I think that we should make a point, you know, going through the election season is always hard. It's probably harder on them than it is for us. So if we can just show a little appreciation, I think that could go a long way. We're asking everybody to write letters to the editor. With the action sheet has information on how you do it with respect to the election, but certainly there's still a lot of news on the front page of your paper. And our communications director, Steve Volk, is always letting us know that the most likely way that you get published is by referencing something that the paper has said as news. Okay, next month I will be calling in from the Omni Hotel where we have Congressional Education Day, so I will actually be in Washington, D.C. for the November call. Our guest is Anthony Leiserwitz. We wanted someone who we thought could make the greatest sense out of the election, and that will be a few days after the election, so he will be our guest speaker for Saturday, November the 10th, I believe. Last thing I want to do is I want to read you a few lines from an op-ed that appeared in the New York Times last Sunday. The title of this op-ed, written by Auden Schindler and Andrew Jones, is "Stopping Climate Change is Hopeless, Let's Do It." I just think that they get at some things, and they almost are bringing more joy to this op-ed than it seems like anybody should have permission to in this day and age. Anyway, they say solving climate change is going to be harder and more improbable than winning World War II, achieving civil rights, defeating bacterial infection, and sending a man to the moon all together. The good news is we're perfect for the job. If the human species specializes in one thing, it's taking on the impossible. We are constitutionally equipped to understand this situation. We are, after all, mortal. And so our very existence is a fight against inevitable demise. We also have experience. The wicked challenges we faced through the ages have often seemed seemingly insurmountable. The Black Death killed off at least a third of Europe in its time. World War II claimed 50 million lives. We won those battles. Sort of, they say. We spent our time as Homo sapiens fighting what J.R.R. Tolkien called the long defeat. And then they quote a journalist, I.F. Stone, who said to explain, the only kinds of fights worth fighting are those you're going to lose, because somebody has to fight them and lose and lose and lose until someday somebody who believes as you do wins, he said. You mustn't feel like a martyr. You've got to enjoy it. Or as Camus put it, one must imagine Sisyphus happy. Love that line. They conclude with this. This work would endow our lives with some of the oldest, most numinous aspirations of humankind, leading a good life, treating our neighbors well, imbuing our short existence with timeless ideas like grace, dignity, respect, tolerance, and love. The climate struggle embodies the essence of what it means to be human, which is what we strive for, the divine. Perhaps the rewards of solving climate change are so compelling, so nurturing, and so natural a piece of, the human soul that we can't help but do it. So that's again from Stopping Climate Change is Hopeless, Let's Do It, in the New York Times from last Sunday, if you want to read the whole piece. All right, everybody, thanks for all you're doing. I read some of the data. It's remarkable what you do every month, and if we're counting up what's happened over the course of the year,